United States v. Dill. Mr. Powers. Proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Can you hear me all right with the mic?
Yep. You don't have to hold it up. It'll be fine.
Terrific. My name is Sean Powers. I'm an attorney at Kirkland & Ellis, and today I'm representing Jeffrey Dill and his appeal. As you recall, the central issue of the appeal is whether the district court took appropriate steps to insulate the jury's deliberations from the influences of the alternate juror that was improperly permitted to be in the deliberation room. There are a couple of points I would like to make that I think will be of assistance.
Let me just ask you this question. There was no discussion about whether to have the alternate deliberate with both counsel. Was there before the judge just did this?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. On appendix page 120 in the opening brief, after reading the written jury instructions to the jury and completing that, the judge asked the trial counsel to approach the bench for a bench conference. She told them for the very first time that it was her intention to send the alternate back into the deliberation room. She said, I don't think we gave them instruction, the alternate instruction on what to do. And then she asked trial counsel whether they had an objection to that.
And they both said no.
They said no.
Because I couldn't remember. I know that there was a discussion that she said she was going to do it in writing. She was going to say in writing what the role of the juror was.
And that's
she
correct.
Definitely instructed the alternate juror. I was just surprised that nobody objected to this because this is just...
I was surprised as well,
Your Honor. And you know whose idea it was, so I didn't... Okay, thank you.
And the key point of that conference, I think, is to that it, at least I, as I read the record, that it was clear at that time that the instruction would be in writing and not simply an oral instruction. And the reason for that is that the history leading up to that conference, the parties had finished an hour and a half negotiation about the final written instructions. The oral instructions were a word-for-word reading of the written instructions. And at that conference, the judge was, it appears, was paging through the written instructions looking to see whether there was a instruction on the limited role of the alternate juror. And to the extent there was any ambiguity in that bench conference, immediately after, 5 or so seconds later, immediately after the attorneys said they did not object, the judge made clear that she would tell the jurors and provide a written instruction as well.
Can the lawyers agree to allow the alternates to participate in the deliberations?
Your Honor, I believe that is an unanswered question of law. I would direct you to Justice Kennedy's concurrence in the Olano opinion. There he makes the point that there are certain structural characteristics of the judicial system that cannot be waived, even with the consent of the parties or with the permission of the trial court. And that he, in his opinion, speaking for himself, this was one of those characteristics.
I wonder why. I mean, because in civil cases, you know, what we do now is usually we only need to have six jurors, but we pick eight. And then if someone drops, you know, if two drop out, you still have your six. So no one's there. I don't think anyone's ever objected to that, even though in a sense you have alternates.
In the
deliberation.
And then also in a civil case, a lot of times alternates end up with the agreement of the parties actually deliberating, but then they get converted from an alternate to a regular juror. And
but that's
I certainly did
that.
Because
you can go up to eight.
Because you can go up to eight.
To a 14.
But it was just odd to me. That's why I asked the question about discussion earlier. There was that conference right before. I just wondered how that even got in the mix.
But what I... The thing that struck me about it is before hearing anything about whether this instruction would be verbal or written, defense counsel says there's no objection. Of course, 24C is ambiguous. And so then the judge says, I'll just tell them. And then the judge, the minute before they go in the room, it looks like, instructs the alternate not to participate in deliberations or vote. So... I understand what you're saying about the written instructions, but I don't see why you think the jurors are going to be confused
The reason that I believe the jurors are confused, Your Honor, is if you go through the written instructions, what the jurors were told...
Well, they use the plural you, and they don't define the plural you to be you, the impaneled jury, not including the alternate every time. But the fact that that phrase isn't in there, in light of the oral instruction, makes this a case rather different from other cases where we have found problems. Ottersberg, for example.
I agree there are some differences, factual differences between Ottersberg, Your Honor. However, if you read the final jury instruction 1, it does use the general you, but the key phrasing is you must follow these instructions even if you disagree with them. I think under any reasonable reading, these instructions are referring to the actual packet of jury instructions.
But the jury instructions never say all of the jurors plus alternates should deliberate. There's no affirmative instruction in that written packet to include the alternate.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the jury instructions are provided to everyone in the jury room, including the alternate juror, and the alternate reading that instruction would take the you to refer to the alternate reading.
In the face of what the judge has just told that person in the courtroom?
Yes, Your Honor. The argument we make, I'm sorry, Your Honor, the light is red. If you'd like me to continue answering, I'm happy to do so.
Yeah, please.
The argument we make in the brief is that all the precedents and data that are available and before the court in the briefing suggests that the alternate would follow the written instructions rather than a one-off oral instruction. There are precedents saying that the jurors are presumed to read the written instructions. There is a decision by the Eastern District of Wisconsin stating that the court will assume the jurors will follow a written instruction and not rely upon their memories of a oral instruction.
At worst, you end up with maybe 13, of course, unlucky number. But at worst, you end up with 13 jurors instead of 12. Right. So what difference does it make?
That is correct, Your Honor, that there will be a difference in the number.
Of course, I assume defendants prefer more rather than fewer jurors.
I can't comment on whether they prefer more or fewer jurors or whether there's anything – I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why can't you comment on that?
Oh, I don't have an opinion on it, Your Honor.
Would you prefer a big jury or a little jury?
I do not know, Your Honor.
You don't know?
No, I do not.
Really? Wouldn't you prefer a larger jury?
Well, you have to have unanimity. That's the point.
Right.
So if you've got more people in the room,
that's right.
It's a little harder to...
Right.
I understand the unanimity point, Your Honor, but it's also possible that a 13th additional juror may be the dominating personality on the jury who would sway others.
The 13th is an alternate, which means he's passed through the same filter as the 12 original jurors, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's something disqualifying about him. He wouldn't be an alternate.
That's correct, Your Honor. However,
why would there be any reason to think that he was unfit or less fit than the other jurors?
It's not that the alternate was somehow less fit than the other jurors, Your Honor.
What difference does it make adding him to the discussion?
The difference is that the... At the time that the jury is impaneled and the 12 regular jurors are selected, the defendant, the right to jury trial, converts from a generalized right to having a decision by a fair jury, which gets to your point about this juror.
What does that have to do with 12 versus 13?
Well, the 12 jurors would be the regular jurors, Your Honor, and the 13th.
The 13th, he sat there all the time. He knew he could be called on to become a juror, so he's presumably paying attention. And then he discovers, through some slip-up, that he is part of the regular jury. So now there are 13, but they were all qualified in the same fashion. So what's the prejudice?
The prejudice in this case, Your Honor, is the possibility that the 13th juror will participate in the deliberations.
No, that's what I'm saying. Assume he deliberates. What is the prejudice?
Your Honor, the answer that depends on, I mean, the answer to your inquiry would turn on what the basis for the decision was. That is, one would have to inquire.
No, so just an accident. It is an accident. Someone doesn't count right. So they end up, there are 13 jurors. But they've all been, qualified in the same way and so on. So what would be the prejudice from that mistake. I suppose a little shocking. We think 12-person jury, 13, oh, strange stuff, you know. But what would be the prejudice?
And the possible prejudice is that that juror would influence the opinions of other jurors and convince jurors who otherwise would have voted not guilty to change their minds.
But that's just a sort of statistical thing, right? There's no reason to think that that juror might be different from the others, but there's no reason to think that, right? He went through the same. Why would you expect him or her to have disproportionate effect on the other jurors?
It's not that the juror would have a disproportionate effect, Your Honor. It's that every possible juror...
Put it this way. If you add a juror who's been qualified in exactly the same way, there's absolutely no reason to think that that is favorable to the prosecutor rather than to the defendant. In other words, there's no basis for thinking that that is prejudicial to one party versus the other.
Under a probabilistic calculation...
Except as Judge Wood said, in general, the larger the jury, because of the unanimity requirement, the better off the defendant is.
And Your Honor, to the
extent... It could work the other way, because, you know, it could be... You need unanimity for acquittal also. But I think generally it's been believed that criminal defendants and their lawyers prefer to have a large jury. They don't want to go down to the 6-person jury. So where's the prejudice?
The prejudice, as I've said, is the possibility that juror would influence the verdict. And while Your Honor may be right that on average...
The 12 angry men scenario, that's what you're actually arguing, is the prejudice, that this one juror is the one who turns everybody else around. But, I mean, it would always be speculative because we can never ask the jury why they decided.
And to the extent there's any uncertainty, Your Honor, then there is always a possibility of remand for an evidentiary hearing. And to the extent that there isn't a record demonstrating actual participation or prejudice by the inclusion of this additional juror, I would contend that the reason for that is the assurance given by the trial court that the written instruction would be included. Because of that instruction, my client had no basis to ask for a detailed polling or some sort of evidentiary hearing in the immediate aftermath of trial to more fully investigate whether this particular alternate juror had some effect on the verdict.
Well, your client didn't speak up at all. I've gone back to the transcript again, and I didn't think there had been any real full discussion of this business of sending the letting the alternate go back. The court just says, I'll give this instruction that the alternate is instructed they may not deliberate. Do you have any objection if we leave them in the jury room? She's referring to the jury instructions. Defense counsel says no. Government counsel says I don't. I don't think it's generally done, but, and the court says, I'll just tell them and then we'll add it to the packet, and they race on. So there was no real full discussion of should the alternate be on the panel or anything. And then there was an opportunity, certainly, when the counsel saw that the instruction had been given, that once the verdict was in, to just ask for a sidebar and say, can we determine, judge, whether or not the alternate, could you bring the alternate over? We could ask the alternate right then, did you participate in the deliberations?
The understanding, though, at that point, Your Honor, was that the written instructions would include a limiting instruction on the role of the alternate.
I'm saying after the verdict. So he hears that I understand orally alternate is told. Okay. Then it doesn't go back. It's, you know, they know that the instructions go back. You get the verdict. The alternate is still there before the court because there's a long scenario where, you know, the judge polls the jurors and they say, yes, it's their verdict. And he realizes, he knew then that the written instruction wasn't back. There's no reason counsel couldn't have said, judge, before you release the jury, could we have a sidebar? And then the alternate could have been brought over right then.
Your Honor, perhaps I read the record differently, but I don't see anything in the record suggesting that counsel or my client were ever aware that the written instructions did not actually include a copy of the oral instruction that was given before deliberations.
So defense counsel didn't get a copy of the written instructions? Defense counsel didn't get a copy? And the government counsel didn't get a copy of written instructions?
My reading of the record, Your Honor, is that they received a copy of the written instructions, a copy of the written instructions which had been corrected for typos, mm-hmm. but that had not been corrected to include the oral instruction to the jury, and that was a copy they had received before the jury was dismissed for deliberations.
I find very peculiar your suggestion of an evidentiary hearing at which 13 jurors are interviewed by the judge to assess the impact of one of them on the other's thinking.
Your Honor, it may be
preposterous. And I think also that kind of hearing is very damaging to the jury system. People hear about this, you know, about this kind of interrogation at the end of a trial. I was asked, what influence did that 13th juror have on your thinking?
I agree with that. It seems to me the only question that could be asked is, did you participate in the deliberations?
Exactly.
Yes or no? And that would have to be the end of the discussion. You can't pursue a yes answer beyond that.
I agree that any hearing would not be that the basis for the jury's decisions would be off limits. I would envision the hearing calling in perhaps not all 13, but at a minimum the alternate juror, presenting that juror with a copy of the written instructions and asking the juror whether they did as they were instructed. For example, did you consult with the other – is this a copy of your instructions? Did you consult with the other jurors according to this instruction? Did you reach a unanimous verdict? And questions along those lines. But to the extent that a hearing like that would be intrusive, that's the reason why we have a bright line rule prohibiting the alternate from even being in the back room in the first place.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Powers. Ms. Brady?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I apologize. I'm a bit under the weather.
Do you need some water?
I'm fine. I think I'll once I start talking, Your Honor.
But you agree that it was a mistake, as 24C is worded, to have that alternate juror go back. We're just talking about prejudice here, right?
Your Honor, I believe, as Your Honor has already pointed out, Rule 24 is now a little bit ambiguous.
Right.
However, I think it is a fair reading of Rule 24, specifically the fact that the court must instruct the jury to begin its deliberations anew should an alternate replace one of the original jurors. I do believe it's a fair reading of Rule 24 that the alternate juror, while retained, is not retained in the deliberation
the
room. I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
The traditional rule about starting over your deliberations, the alternate is a terrible disadvantage, right? They've made up their mind. The others have made up their mind. And this person comes in and they say, well, what do you think? Or do you disagree? Or we think we should do this. And it's just the alternate. It hasn't heard anything. What's he going to say? Well, we have to start from scratch, right? Forget everything you said. I want to start over.
Right. They deliberated for a long time in the Ryan case, though. Mm-hmm. They started anew. This is exactly the procedure that was used.
Well, that was when they'd been out for a couple of weeks, right?
Well, they'd been deliberating for a couple of days. Then the information about the criminal background and the non-disclosure came out, so the voir dire, a couple people are kicked off the jury goes back in, and the judge instructs them to begin their deliberations anew.
Well hadn't the alternates gone home? There was an interval, wasn't there?
Yeah, the alternates had gone home.
Weeks,
I mean, that's the normal process, too. But what you do is you instruct your alternates.
Jury room. That's
right.
Yeah.
You instruct the alternates, and you say, you're being released, but you still cannot discuss the case. The court will have to call you back, and that's what happened.
And they're called back. But the point is, there were some people who had been in the jury room for the unsuccessful round one.
Right.
And then everybody goes back and deliberates in round two.
But there's always the question, how much did the recalled alternates 2 weeks later contribute to the...
I have no idea.
There's certainly some practical benefit to the fashion in which this district court acted.
I'm bothered, though. Actually, I'd be happier if the person joined the deliberations because there's something awkward about having the 12 people are talking. This guy is sitting in a corner, you know, quiet. Is he making faces? Is he... I don't know. It just seems very awkward, very awkward situation.
It's very difficult, I think, either way, Your Honor. You've got this.
Doesn't Justice Kennedy suggest that really the wording of the rule and the better practice is you can retain the alternates, but they really can't be sitting in the same room as the deliberating jury?
You're right, Your Honor, and that is what led to our concession regarding whether or not there was error. But I think what is really critical here is the complete lack of prejudice shown. That Alano is very clear that it can't be some theoretical prejudice that may have, could have occurred. What is the specific showing of prejudice in this case?
But consistent with the evidentiary rules, 606, I think, how would you ever show prejudice from this situation?
Well, in Ottersberg, you'd show prejudice by the fact that it was very clear that there was deliberation by the...
So a showing of deliberation would be enough to show prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
Show prejudice?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why would that show prejudice?
Well, I think that would show an outside influence on a jury.
What's the outside influence?
Well, the alternate is not one of those 12 who is empaneled and given...
The whole point of the alternates is they're supposed to pay the same attention as everybody else. They're just as qualified.
Absolutely.
So why is there prejudice from having 13 people deliberate rather than 12?
There would not be prejudice from expanding a jury. However, under our rules, 12 people are those that are sworn and...
No, they're all sworn. But what is... But what is the prejudice? Is this what the Supreme Court calls a structural error where you have to reverse if there's...
There may be structural error in that if you have a right to
no
these
prejudice.
12 people and no one else.
And I think that would be, under the case law, that is the prejudice, that this alternate would be considered an outside influence as he was not one of those...
considered an outside influence because if one of the other jurors had fallen out, he would be deliberating with all the rights of the other jurors. So why could he be thought of as outside?
Well, because as he was instructed...
It's so formalistic.
I see Your Honor's point.
Oh, you're saying he's being disobedient because he was told not to deliberate.
Well, that's correct. In this case, the alternate was very clearly told. And in fact, he was told twice about, or she, I should say, was told twice about what an alternate's duties are. And this was not really briefed. You know, if I could finish my thought, I see my time is up. At page 108, or 107, 108 of the trial transcript, the judge did speak to what the duties of the alternate were and was very clear in that preliminary empanelment phase that an alternate is allowed to listen and must listen to, carefully consider, listen to the evidence, but would not be allowed to deliberate. She reiterated that at the very close of the case. And I just can't buy into the argument that there was any type of confusion because of the collective view that was generally utilized in the course of these instructions.
Given you understand this to be a confusion argument, not a disobedience argument?
I believe that the appellant
That's
is...
That's how I understand the appellant's brief.
That he's arguing that there was some
that
type
they're
of...
They're confused because the written instructions say one thing and the oral instructions say something else, and so they're confused about what they're supposed to be doing, not that they're disobeying anything.
I believe that's his argument. I just don't think there's any support whatsoever in the record that there was any confusion. Okay. If there are no further questions, I thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brady. Mr. Powers, do you have anything further?
No.
And you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your efforts on that.